Goswami he's the editor of the Back to Godhead Harry Krishna magazine, a publisher, a mom, and a teacher. Thank you all for coming, and I hope you contribute to this interactive talk and ask as many questions as you have, and feel free to do so, and interrupting me whenever, or interrupting him whenever. My name is Malara. I'm a second year politics and African studies student, and if you want to hang around until the end, there's some literature and some vegetarian food. Want to stay and hang around until the end, that's what you will get, and what you can get information literature wise. If I say anything wrong, pose a question wrong, please do correct me. Would you like to introduce yourself and say something about you and your life and your work?
Let's see how this goes. Thank you. How's the microphone level there? Not so good, right? Is that better? Can you hear? Yeah? All right. Thank you. Well, as you said, Malar, my main work is in publishing. I do editorial work in spiritual publishing. I met my spiritual teacher in 1968 in New York City, and I could tell you history about that, but maybe we'll see what kind of questions you might have. I was about your age, maybe. Some of you might be a little older. I was about 18 at that time, a little older now. And I'll tell you, I spent some time after leaving high school, American system, at university, Carnegie Mellon, it's called now, pretty good university. And I saw that students there were there for four reasons. One reason at the time, this was the 1960s, was to avoid the Vietnam draft, which was quite a good reason for being in university. Another reason was some were very career oriented, they were going to go out there and make their mark in the job market. Third group had left high school, they really weren't ready to go into the job market. And mommy and daddy were going to pay for them to spend 4 years on this in this park with nice people, beautiful girls and boys, and they could have a bit of leisure for 4 years and just turn in a few test papers and have a good time. And the fourth group were there because they were looking for knowledge. And it seemed to me at the time that that was the group that was being the most cheated. Because in my experience, if you asked a professor, who are you and why are you here and what is the purpose of your life and why are we here at this university studying, what is the ultimate point of it all, their answers would be dull. They wouldn't have answers at depth. They could tell you what their scholarly enterprise was, they could tell you so many other things. But in terms of delivering meaning, ultimate meaning, it just wasn't there. And what is knowledge if it's disconnected from ultimate purpose? Really, it's illusion. Knowledge without purpose, knowledge without deeper understanding of the most basic questions, who we are, what our life is for, is not knowledge. That thought I had at the time, which is why I left the university community And by good fortune, sometime later, I came in touch with my spiritual teacher, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, long name. But I found that, on the contrary, if you asked him the same questions, he had very definite answers, and he had very definite train of thought underlying those answers, substantial train of thought underlying those answers. And that's where my interest began, and that's where I still am.
Is that okay for a start?
How did you meet him or find him?
How did I meet him? Well, I met him actually by joining his society. He had at that time a small storefront in New York City. He'd left New York and gone back to India for some time, and it was in his absence that I met his students in New York. And then when he came back about 2 months later, I met him.
Are there any questions so far?
Yes.
Good.
Bertrand Russell said that knowledge is this one possession we have, which is never ending. It's like a river. You can take it as much as you want, and everybody can, and there's so much of it that we'll never compete. So this really contradicts what you said, that knowledge should be proactive, or should be... I think Bertrand Russell really was thinking in terms of knowledge for knowledge's sake, and that was okay.
I'm not sure that we're in contradiction, although I'm sure that Bertrand Russell and I would probably differ on all sorts of things. But knowledge doesn't have to... By knowledge, I don't mean that now you've got it, it's in a box, you know how many square meters it takes up, and you put a little package in it and send it to your own address at the post, and you're done. That's not at all what I have in mind. Knowledge should expand, knowledge should be ongoing, should be progressive, knowledge should lead to more knowledge, and that should lead to still further knowledge. But there is such a thing as knowledge for knowledge's sake with no purpose, where I know how big this is, I know how much it costs, I know so many things, and ultimately, I don't know what in the world I'm doing with that information. I'm just being processed. I'm being given information, I take the information, I spit it back, and I have knowledge. At the end, I'm certified I have knowledge. But do I know, do I have a clear understanding of deeper issues? No. Do they matter? Maybe no. You know, at the end of my education, deeper issues don't matter. What matters is, you know, getting hired by a good company. And that's, you know, matters more than the issues that I haven't even addressed or brought up or maybe even thought about, even as a professor. That's my point.
Thank you very much.
Can you say a bit more about your guru whom you met in the 60s? Was he an American?
Yes, I can say a little more about him. Thank you. No, he was not American. He was from India, from West Bengal to be precise, from Calcutta to be more precise. And his teaching was quite different from what was being popularly taught at the time. America in the mid-1960s was full of gurus, full of swamis, full of all sorts of spiritual things. There was, right around that time, was the heyday of chant. A secret mantra 15 minutes in the morning and 15 minutes in the evening, and you pay $25 and you meditate. There were all sorts of things going on. My spiritual, and the general trend of it was a sort of a what we might now call a New Age discourse. We talk about the oneness of all beings. We talk about finding yourself in the flow of greater reality. You know, we find this kind of vague, soupy kind of rhetoric, record, how everything is kind of one with everything else, and whatever you're doing, it's the same as everything else, because really, everything is everything, and everything is nothing, and nothing is everything, and, you know, it goes on like that. And our spiritual teacher was very definite. He was particularly clear on certain points of practice and certain points of understanding. First point of practice was, without some self-discipline, there's no spiritual progress. If someone is telling you that, you know, whatever you're doing, just continue doing that, whatever you like to smoke, whatever you like to drink, whatever you like to do, wherever your senses take you, that's all fine, just subscribe to whatever idea it is or whatever little practice you want to add on, he's cheating you royally. That's trash. Just as if someone says that university means you just come and you have a nice time and you don't have to study and you don't have to take any tests. It's out of the question. If you want to get education, there's sacrifice, there's discipline. So spiritual progress also, or inner progress, means there has to be some self-discipline. It must mean that. Otherwise, even if in sports, if you want to make progress, you have to follow some discipline. Maybe you give up smoking so that you can compete, and you know, there must be discipline. Otherwise, you don't go anywhere. So our spiritual master was very clear about that. He, quite contrary to the going with the flow of the 1960s, he was anti-flow. He insisted that his students give up any form of intoxicants, which were, of course, for many people, the way for spiritual progress. And he said, forget it. Not even coffee or tea. You're already intoxicated enough. No need to take anything more. No gambling. No non-vegetarian food. If you want to make spiritual progress and kill your fellow creatures at the same time or pay somebody else to do it, you're not going to make a whole lot of progress. And no unrestricted sex. Which, well, what do you mean, no one? No. He was against just mix and match and mix again and match again. He said, no, if you want to make spiritual progress, there must be self-discipline. So, whatever our initial impression of that, it means he's serious. You know, we're not kidding around here. We're talking about a serious process for making spiritual advancement. And I may be prepared to do all these things, I may not be prepared to do these things, I may have questions about whether and why and if and how, but it means we're talking serious stuff now. We're no longer in the realm of, well, really, just be yourself and whatever you are, and that's out. The second thing is that he had very definite teachings to give that were also contrary to what was going around. What was generally going around is that when we talk about a supreme or an absolute or an ultimate truth, we mean something which is ultimately beyond form, beyond names, beyond qualities, beyond description, beyond thinking, beyond anything. Something essentially impersonal and homogeneous. That was the one, the great light, the unspeakable truth. That's the general discourse. And he challenged that. His essential challenge was that in the world around you, you have variety. Here we have black people, we have white people, we have tan people, we have tall people, we have short people, we have fat ones and thin ones and middle-sized ones, we have very smart people, we have very stupid people. Sorry to say, but it's true. We have all sorts of varieties. We have yellow, we have green, we have name a variety, we have it. Now, by what process does this immense variety proceed from something which has no form, no qualities, by definition, no variety whatsoever. Because if there's variety, it's not it. If that it has no variety, no differentiation, no anything there, where do you get variety here? If it's not in the warehouse, how did it get to the shop? So his presentation was that the absolute truth is not an unadulterated, impersonal entity, but that it could be understood properly in three features. What are those three features? The first is that impersonal entity, that great, unspeakable, indescribable truth beyond all limits, beyond all names and forms and qualities. That's a preliminary realization. There's some great something. There's something greater than us that we can't describe, which is everywhere, which is all-pervading, and which we don't really understand. There's a second angle of vision on that same supreme truth, and that is that the supreme entity is also within your heart. When you're looking for knowledge, when you're looking for understanding, even when you're not looking for knowledge or understanding, there's some source of inspiration, some source of guidance within each one of us, which is coming from beyond us. It's coming from beyond us. That can be called, in Sanskrit it's called Paramatma, in English you can say Supersoul or Oversoul, but it's the form of the absolute within oneself that one perceives as one traces one's own thoughts and says, where am I getting this from? That super soul is within me, within you, equally within all living beings. And the third perspective on the absolute gives us the picture of a personality of Godhead. That is to say that I'm a person, you're a person, each one of us is personal. And when we come to that understanding of the absolute truth, we again meet a person, but not a person of this material world, rather the supreme, unlimited person. And someone said, well, a person means not, that's a limit, you're placing a definition which is by nature limited. No. It's a person who's discrete, specific, but by definition, beyond any limitation. I have a form that means I'm limited. If I'm here in London, I'm not in Johannesburg. But when we speak of unlimited form, that unlimited form can be here, can be there, can be in the next place, and still not lose form. Something like the sun, which can be in Johannesburg and London and New York and lots of other places. Could be on my head, on your head, on the next man's head. And it doesn't make it something abstract or something with no qualities or no form and so on. So these three aspects are actually one. That is, the supreme is the supreme. You can't have two or seven or three supremes. But the supreme can be realized progressively from different angles of vision. Again, something like the sun, you wake up in the morning, you look out your window, and you see the light everywhere, and you say, the sun is here. And that's true. Then if you were to look up, then you'd see a very specific planet. You'd say, well, that's the sun. But it's not a matter of argument that the person who thought the sun was what was coming in his window is wrong. And I'm right, I see the planet. It's simply two angles of vision on the same reality. And if you could go to the sun, then you might find that the sun was inhabited, and that there was a president of the sun, a sun god, in charge of the sun. And you could meet him and talk to him about everything that's going on in the sun. So he's also the sun. But again, there's no difference between any of the three features. So in this way, philosophically, he had something very particular to say, and in terms of process, something very particular. Is that okay?
What does it mean to you to be a monk and to renounce everything material?
What does it mean to be a monk and renounce everything material? What does it mean to renounce it? You probably saw that I sat down and put this thing, which must cost at least 50 or 80 pounds, over here. And it looks very material. It's made of material stuff. It costs material money. So how have I renounced everything material? Our understanding is that, first of all, nothing actually belongs to us. This is not my property. The elements of which it's fashioned were here before I came. When I leave the scene, they'll still be here. For some time I say, this is mine. This is my recorder. This is my house. This is my money. This is my family. This is my this. This is my that. My country. But it's here before I come. It's here after I go. So in what sense is it mine? It's not mine, actually. There's a higher proprietor to whom it belongs, and I'm borrowing the stuff. Even my body is on loan. The stuff of which the body is made is not actually my property. I can't command it, actually, and be thoroughly in charge of it. It's on loan, just as your apartment is on loan. So renunciation means not that I give something up, because it's not mine to begin with, but it means that I recognize the actual proprietor. And I use it for that supreme proprietor of everything.
But I guess you bought it with your money, so it is your property.
Really? You know, I buy a car with my money, and then it's my car, and then someone else buys it for me, then it's his car, and then it goes to the next person, it's his car. So temporarily you can say it's mine, but temporarily mine means it's not actually mine. It only means it's in my hands for some time. Like I say, my money, I have £5, this is my money. But 5 minutes ago it wasn't mine, and when I spend it again, it's not mine. So my claim, this is my money, is not a substantial claim. And even while it's in my hands, it's not mine. It's not actually my property. In the Bhagavad Gita, we hear from Krishna that it's my property. Krishna says, whatever there is my energy. As the sunlight is the energy of the sun, everything is ultimately the energy of the Supreme. Even I'm the energy of the Supreme. You're the energy of the Supreme. We're all connected, ultimately, with the Supreme. And we all belong to. We're all parts of the Supreme. Now we're acting as if we were disconnected. And that disconnectedness is causing us untold difficulty. What is that difficulty? No one wants to get old. We're all going to get old. Some of us are already, well into it. Some of us, we're so far away. But everyone has to get old, and no one wants to. Everyone has to get diseased, and no one wants it. No one wants to die, and everyone's forced to. And birth also is something that we have to accept. without argument. And that's also painful. These are all unnatural for us. Therefore, we don't like them. If you ask me, do I want to get old? No, I don't want to get old. Diseased? No. Dead? No. Why not? Why don't we say, well, it's great, you know? Looking forward to the experience. Because it's unnatural to us. Even a cockroach, you try and step on him, he runs away. Why? He wants to live forever. He doesn't want to die. In our present situation, we're in an unnatural condition. Because we've separated ourselves from that supreme reality. On the platform of reality, there's permanence, there's knowledge, and therefore we're looking for knowledge, we want knowledge, we want more knowledge, because it's natural for us to have knowledge. But in the material situation, our knowledge is blocked, our knowledge is confused, and in our natural state, we'll have clear knowledge. Knowledge, existence, permanent existence, and joyfulness. If we advertised, you know, we're having a program, come this evening and you'll all be unhappy, you know, you wouldn't be here. We're looking for happiness. Why? Because it's natural. But we're trying to get happiness by owning something, and you know what it's like to own something. As soon as you own it, it starts becoming less valuable. And then you lose it, or it breaks, or it's no longer what you wanted. The whole material world is like that. It does not satisfy, because we're spiritual beings by nature, and no amount of matter is going to satisfy a spiritual being. It just will not work. So it's another kind of an illusion to think that this is mine and I can hold on to it and it will make me happy. The whole world is trying to do that and failing. It does not work. Full stop. And even the poorest man will be happy if he has inner realization of who he is, what his relationship is with the Supreme, how to act in that relationship. He'll be happy.
So if I wanted to become Hare Krishna, what would I have to do? What kind of, except not intoxicating myself, and what else would I have to do?
Positively, we recommend this chanting. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. It's a transcendental vibration. We don't charge for it. It's not a secret. But when you chant, you'll experience purification of heart. Not that, okay, I chanted 5 minutes, you know, my heart has just been through the laundry. But you go on chanting, and you'll experience how your heart becomes free from anxieties, free from so many misconceptions, joyful, because you're coming in touch with Krishna. What does it mean, coming in touch with Krishna? When we say the Supreme, Krishna means that ultimate Supreme. And the nature of the ultimate is there's no difference between the Supreme and His name. You and I are different from our names, or the thing and the substance, the thing and its name are different. If you chant Coca-Cola, 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 you're still thirsty. But on the absolute platform, vibration and substance are equal. The name and the thing have no duality. So by chanting, you experience the presence of Krishna. It's not something theoretical. It's something experiential. So even someone may not be prepared to follow the harsh rules that might be involved. But by chanting, the heart becomes purified one gets a higher taste. And then the things that were so difficult become very easy. That's practical experience. Another question now? Out beyond? Sure.
What do you mean by higher taste?
Well, just like if you had a little biscuit in your hand, and I said, and you were hungry, and I said, throw the biscuit away. You'll say, wait a second, that's my biscuit, I'm hungry, and I'm not going to throw it away and get lost. But if I come to you with a big plate full of whatever your favorite food is, you know, fancy and delicious and everything, then you'll, and I say, I'll give you all this, but you have to throw away the biscuit. Will you do that? Yeah, sure. Why? Because there's a higher taste there. There's taste to the biscuit, but there's more taste than, you know, 50 different varieties of well-prepared things. So there's a taste to material enjoyment. There's a taste to a cigarette. I smoke a cigarette, there's a taste. There's a taste to whatever. Name something in the material world. There's a taste to it. But the taste is not very satisfying. It's advertised as satisfying. They advertise that you smoke this cigarette and it's so smooth, it's so satisfying. But it's a lie. And more than that, if it were just unsatisfying, that would be good. But it's actually destructive, harmful. So for the sake of satisfaction, we're getting some little taste, which is not satisfying. You smoke one, you throw it away, and you pick up the next one. And we're harming ourselves at the same time. So higher taste means that beyond the taste of these temporary things, which are, number one, temporary, and number two, unrewarding, and number three, even troublesome. When we come to the spiritual platform, there's a taste which is free from trouble, which is natural, which is permanent, and which is constitutionally joyful. We're trying to infuse material things with joy. You know, we talk it up and we say, you know, this is the best, you know, party or the best club or the best, you know, whatever it is. And we talk it up and kind of psych ourselves into this is really going to be something. But at the end, it's really not what it's talked up to be. And therefore, we're disappointed. We're disappointed. The material world is constitutionally like that. We're thinking it's just that I got the configuration wrong. You know, I got the girl with the blue eyes instead of the brown eyes. That's the problem. You know, I'm not the kind of person who's meant to live with a blue-eyed girl. And, you know, I mean, just the whole thing is wrong. And if I, you know, if it were only Susie instead of Jane, everything would be different. But it's not like that. Configure it this way, configure it that way, configure it a third way. Any way you configure it, the material world is constitutionally unrewarding. Constitutionally unrewarding. And spiritual understanding and spiritual engagement, spiritual realization is inherently satisfying and inherently permanent by its nature.
But what is wrong with short-sighted happiness? We're all looking for, we're all pursuing happiness.
Sure.
And if within the material world, it makes you happy to go to a club and dance for a few hours, why is that wrong?
What's wrong? Here's the problem. That, first of all, the Bhagavad Gita says, dukkhalayam ashashvatam. Okay, what is this happiness? First thing is that the happiness is not really happiness. What do I mean that? I go to a club, I dance. First of all, I'm out however many pounds. It cost me something. Second of all, okay, I have to go there and drink. That means I've clouded up my mind. Is that really something that's in my best interest? To cloud up my mind? And then I meet people and I engage with them in some sort of interactions. When their minds are cloudy and my minds are cloudy, my mind is cloudy. Where does that go?
Who says that drinking and dancing within a club go together?
Okay, we just go to the club and dance. All right, it's a teetotaler's club. We go there and drink fruit juice and we dance. All right, and we go. We have a good time and it's lovely. First thing is that it may not be so lovely, actually. That I'm, again, telling myself that I'm having a good time. It's so great. I met this really nice boy and he was so, I mean, he was just like nobody else. He was so nice to me and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it's great, except later it's not so great. Because then he finds another girl and he says, you know, get lost. Or he says, you're the girl for me, and then I'm pregnant. And then, I can kill the kid or have it, but either way it's a problem. Or we get married and we live happily ever after for 5 or 7 years. And, you know, so it's supposed to be great, but it's not always what it's chalked up to be. But let's say it's great. It's really good, but then it has a beginning and an end. So then now I have to do something else. I went to the club, I danced, it was really nice. And now what? Now I'm bored. So what? No, okay, we're going to look forward to going to the club again next week and so on. It's little crumbs of happiness. And the crumbs are finally taken away. This happiness that I'm getting by the dancing and this, it's all based on the body. Can't dance without a body. It's all proceeding from the body. I see this, I touch that, I hear this. And the body itself is not a stable platform for happiness. It's not a stable source for happiness. I'm trying to get happiness from the body. I'm thinking, in fact, that I am the body. If you ask me who I am, I say, well, I'm an American. Or I'm British, or I'm Smith, or I'm Jones, or I'm young, or I'm old, or I'm this, or I'm that. I'm thinking in terms of this body. As if the body were myself, which it's not. Which it's not. So I'm getting happiness for this body and its senses, as if that were giving happiness to me. But because I'm not this body, feeding the body what it wants still leaves me hungry. You have your car and you fill it with petrol and now you don't have to eat, right? No. Because you're not your car, you're just driving around in it. Feeding the car doesn't feed you. So doing whatever it is to satisfy the senses still leaves the living being himself dissatisfied. Otherwise, you know, you live in Britain, I live in America, you know, super ultra advanced countries, whatever you want, order it on the internet, it's on your desk the next day. What do you want? And name a material thing, you can have it. If you're not living in Myanmar, or in some third world country where you might have to be deprived of something. Basically, in Britain, you want it, you can have it. So, in Britain, everyone's walking around jubilant. The faces are all smiles. Everyone's in untold ecstasy throughout the day. And if not, why not? Because we have all the stuff. You want a girl, the girls are all there. You want a boy, the boys are all there.
you're a boy, you want a boy, the boys are all there. Whatever you want, it's there. Things, they're all there. Do anything, sure, why not? It's all there. Okay, so where's the equation going wrong? If it's all available, we should be the happiest people in the world. And you know, go out on the street and do your own inventory. Tell me how it looks. Are they all really jolly, jolly, jolly out there? Why not? So our proposition is, because the living being himself is starving. The petrol is being put in the car, and the driver is hungry. You have a question?
I wanted to say, if, as you say, there's all this diversity around us,
mm-hmm.
and I would also say that not everyone is searching for happiness. A lot of people, I presume, you know, have a desire to work hard, have a desire to sort of affect the lives of people around them in a positive way, in the matter, like, which, you know, exact path they choose to do that.
Okay.
Perhaps the way you talk sounds like there's one path for true happiness. So it isn't something that I necessarily disagree with.
Okay.
And I think a spiritual aspect to your life is very important.
Right.
But also I think that we are what we are for a reason. And that
we are what we are for a reason, okay.
And that there needs to be like an element of balance. Perhaps at the end of one's life, be a case of, well, I've lived my life and I've done my material things, I've worked hard, I'm not necessarily earning money, but, you know, I've worked hard on my mission that I've chosen.
Let's see if I can get all your points. First point is that we're not all looking for happiness. Some of us, for example, just want to work hard, and perhaps we want to work hard for the upliftment of others. So it's not that we're all cut from the same cookie cutter, we're all trying to do the same thing. And apart from that, you agree that spirituality is an important component to one's life, but it's not everything, of course. And why not sort of leave that to its appropriate place at the end of life, after we've done the other things? Is that a fair summary of your points, or did I miss a couple there?
Sort of, yeah, but except that, I mean, I think the spiritual aspect needs to be an ongoing project.
Okay.
Throughout your life.
Excuse me?
Throughout your whole life.
Okay, it should be there throughout your whole life, but you really put it into gear at the end.
No, like, you put it into gear all the time.
Okay.
But you also have...
You also have the other things going
yeah.
on. Okay, so let's talk about those things one by one. First of all, I don't mean to say that everybody is just a shameless hedonist. You know, that as soon as we pile out of this room, we're all going to be going looking for the nearest club and doing whatever it is that turns our senses on. I don't mean to say that. Some of us get our pleasure from doing some altruistic work, some of us from doing some political work, some of us from doing some, you know, all sorts of things. True. Generally, we don't work, however, unless we're paid. As much as I say I love my work, if you don't pay me, I won't be there Monday morning. So I work because there's something that I want to get, which I think is going to, in some way, make my life happier. Or let's say that I'm really an altruist. I'm just working selflessly for the Red Cross or a cause. That's better. Now I'm no longer just working for my own interest. I've extended it. Let's say I'm not such an altruist, but I'm working for first just for me. Then I get married. Now I'm working for, you know, me and my wife and some children. So it's not just me. I've extended my area of interest. I'm interested in making others happy. Let's say I go beyond that. Now I want to work for my country. I want to work for mankind.
So, in fact, the broader you go, the higher you are, the more exalted your life is. But it's still within the realm of limitation. I care about mankind, but I chomp on the animals, for example. Or I love my country and I stomp on the country next door. Or I love my family and I compete with the 10 other families. So my altruism or my altruism is still within a conditioned kind of a state. If you extend it further, if you extend it to the ultimate point where your goal is to of service, is not just to serve yourself, not just to serve your family, not just to serve your country, not just to serve mankind, but to serve the ultimate, to serve the supreme, you've come to the highest point of service. And when you're there, you're automatically going to be serving everyone. Next point, we agree that something to cultivate throughout our life. There's an interesting history in one of the Puranas about a child named Prahlad, who was he was spiritually advanced from his childhood. He met a great sage and became an enlightened little boy. And he was trying to get his friends on board, saying, come on, let's do something. Let's chant Hare Krishna. Let's hear something about spiritual events. And the kids said, oh, come on, you know, we're 5 years old, let us play. When, you know, later, old age, you know, when our grandparents will do this stuff. And he said, you better do it now. Why? Okay, you're going to spend, say, 10 years, 15 years of your life as kids. And you're going to be kicking balls around and doing all of that kind of thing. Then you're going to hit middle age, and then it's you see a girl, you think she's nice, and there's all of that kind of interaction. So you're busy with that for another few years, then you get married, and then you're working hard to support your family, to see to your home and your relatives and your job and all of that. And then you're old, and by this time you're fagged out. You know, where's your spiritual realization? If you're leaving it till then, you're too busy now because you're kids, you're too busy later because you're chasing boys and girls around, you're too busy after that because you're working and supporting your family, and then at the end, you don't even know when the end is going to be. You know, you think you're going to live till you're 70, and you're cut off at 40 or 20. Apart from that, he said to them, okay, you've got 24 hours a day, subtract 10 or 12, because you're asleep during that time. So you just cut your life in half. If you're going to live 100 years, really there's only 50 of real time, production time. And again, out of that, you're spending so much of it doing this, so much of it spent, your spiritual time is less. So he said, now, when you're young, and you have the time, go for it now. Then it's yours. Next point, it doesn't mean that all I do is sit and chant and meditate and I don't eat, I don't talk to anyone, I don't work, I don't function, I enter into some sort of ozone and I'm never seen again. It's practical. I realize my relationship with the Supreme or with Krishna, and in that relationship I see everything else. If I'm married, I see that marriage means that there's two of us for spiritual advancement. It's not just a mutual sense gratification society of two, but it has now a spiritual connection. And if there's children, then now there's more people to make spiritual progress. If there's something I'm doing in the world, suppose I'm making some money, the money can be used in Krishna's service. If I have a microphone, I can use it. If I have a university, I can use it. Anything. So it doesn't mean dropping activities, because activity is illusion. But it means infusing all of our activities with spiritual purpose. And okay? We have another question. Behind the pillar? Or no, okay, there you are. Well, we'll just say Krishna.
Yeah. I was just wondering, would you say then that there's no possibility of finding true lasting happiness through marriage?
When I say that there's no possibility of finding true lasting happiness through marriage.
Yeah, because you say the only way to find the good taste is to get it through the spiritual taste.
Would I say that the only way to get the good taste is spiritually, and there's no lasting happiness in marriage? Yes. Now, why would I say such an outrageous thing?
Have you ever married?
No.
Experience true love.
Oh, excuse me?
Experience true love.
Without marriage, how about that? I saved myself so much money.
I have parents who've been happily married for 40 odd years. And
you're
still happy.
Your parents are happily married for 40 some odd years. Good.
Everything is perfect, and they don't think any spiritual guru type
thing. Right.
Any
they're happily married, and they've been happily married for 40 years, so they have lasting happiness. No. They have lasting for some time happiness.
Okay, lasting till death. Though.
Lasting till death. Probably they won't die together. One will die before the other. And then, you know, that lasting relationship dissolves.
But Grandma's still happy.
I'm glad she's happy.
Even though her husband has died, she's still happy about marriage.
She may be happy about marriage, but the marriage is over. The man is gone. Grandpa's no longer there. Unless, if her happiness depends on her relationship with Grandpa, it's over. Unless she has some other source of happiness, she's going to be miserable, as many people are. You can visit people in old age homes whose husband or wife is no longer there, and they're quite often, you know, despondent or mad even. You know, visit someone in an old age home, and my husband's coming Tuesday, you know, he's been dead for 20 years, but anytime you talk to her husband's coming back on Tuesday. You know, not everyone goes mad like that. But my point is that if we define lasting as actually lasting, this is not. This is lasting for 20 years, 40 years. Good. That used to be the standard, you know. Now it's like, wow, her parents have been married for 40 years. But it's good. I'm happy that they're happily married. But that's not permanent.
Isn't this a slightly nihilistic situation?
Excuse me?
It's a slightly nihilistic situation, because if everyone tries to achieve spiritual happiness, then they're not going to get married, and the human race is going to go back down from the peak, and we're going to get a slight...
If everybody tries for spiritual happiness, then nobody's going to get married, and that's the end of the world.
Yeah, because lots of people...
Yeah, the people
not
are...
Not no children being made.
Of course, that's probably... You know, everybody's trying to move things in that direction, knock down the population, so it wouldn't be... You know, let's try it for 50 or 100 years. Try it the other way, let's do this. But I doubt that we're seriously in danger of seeing that happen, that everyone goes stark raving spiritual, and that's the end of marriage. You know, it's kind of like everybody's going to grow get rich all at once. It's just not going to happen. That won't happen. But if, just as, well, not everyone's going to be a PhD candidate. Not everyone's going to do so many things. Not everyone's going to be a philanthropist. But let's not talk about everyone, let's talk about you. Let's talk about me, let's talk about us. You know, what the whole world does, we can leave till later. The whole world is not going to Soaz. If the whole world tried, you know, what would happen in this place?
But you, is it a sensible proposition for you to invest your energy in investigating or even pursuing spiritual happiness? That's really the question before us. It's not mutually exclusive with marriage for this reason, that the Vedic literature, by Vedic literature I mean the traditional sapiential literature of India, recognizes that we have two kinds of needs, material and spiritual. I can't deny that I have basic material needs, like eating, for example. I said, well, I'm spiritually realized, I don't eat anymore. No, you are to be eating, sleeping, can't really do without it, mating, another basic human need, and defending. We need to defend ourselves from time to time. We need to have some security. The animals do these things. They eat, they sleep, they mate, they defend. Human beings do these things. And they're necessary. No, necessary. But they're not everything. What's your goal in life? Well, to eat, to sleep, to have sex, and defend myself. Oh, great, that's really fantastic. Yeah. Well, every dog does that. Are we no better than dogs? Two-legged dogs? So, fine, they need to do it, we need to do it. But that's not our purpose. Not that, why am I'm living to eat? Why am I'm living to sleep? Why am I living to fight? Why am I living for sex? No. Those things should be as much as needed. But we try to pump them up, you know? Eating, newer experiences in eating, super, ultra, fantastic, like you've never had it before, eating. And what is it? It's what the dog does. The dog is as happy eating his little bone as you are in your top of the world restaurant. At the end of the meal, he's eaten, you've eaten, he goes to sleep, you go to sleep, he's happy, you're happy. It's the same for all of us. The fantastic, ultra, super, nothing like it, newest, greatest, never before experienced sex life that the human being has is the same as the sexual experience of the mosquito. They get sexual satisfaction. We get sexual satisfaction. Yeah, you're looking like, oh no, really? Yes, really. It's the same. There's nothing qualitatively different about what the animal gets out of it and what we get from it. It's the same thing. You know, it really is. We like to think that it's something, you know, categorically different. It's not. It's not. It's the same thing. But human society pumps it up and tries to make it something that's going to just turn your life into permanent euphoria. And the result is disappointment. Because it can never match the expectation. If the expectation is just heaven, when the reality sets in, we're going to be disappointed. That's the sorry truth about love in the material world, or sex in the material world. It's built up to be like nothing else under the sun, and really it's the same old thing. Mm-hmm. Which again is not to say, you know, stop it, but to try to fix our happiness on that is going to result in a big letdown at the end. Yeah?
Hi. There seems to be a big emphasis on moving away from material pleasures.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's really two ways of looking at material pleasure. I mean, there's eating a bar of chocolate and then after finishing the chocolate, still craving for another piece
mm-hmm.
and still desiring another piece.
That's right.
But there's also eating a piece of chocolate and just enjoying it and being fulfilled with the piece of chocolate that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's those two very different things, and to experience material pleasure just for what it is, is not necessarily a bad thing.
Now, I'm not saying, you know, somehow or other, if the chocolate tastes good, you know, put a rubber band around your tongue or something because, you know, you just did the wrong thing. No. There's a natural pleasure that comes from, well, Bhagavad Gita analyzes it by saying the contact of the senses with their objects. The eye sees something nice, the fingers touch something nice, the ear hears something nice. It's contact of the sense with an object of the sense. That results in a certain amount of pleasure. Okay. We don't say, deny it, pretend it's not there, but just accept what it is. It's really kind of small time. It's not the ultimate thing that a human being lives for when he's living for the highest, to his highest potential, to use a worn-out phrase. It's not the be-all and end-all. It's just, that's business as usual. Like here, you're coming to the university. Every day you're eating. Now, is that why you've come? Okay, you get a certain amount of satisfaction when you eat. Maybe the food's good. You're happy about that. But you have a higher purpose here. So I think I'm agreeing with you. I'm saying that, fine, you know, take your pleasure that comes naturally. Accept that. But just accept that that's not really the thing. That's not really the point. That's maintenance. And when you're maintaining the body, you'll get some satisfaction doing it. And it's not, I should also add, it's not just, you know, give up this, give up this, give up this. But as you brought up, we're talking about a higher taste. When you get the higher thing, automatically you just lose interest in the lower thing. It's not that somebody has to drag you away kicking and screaming. You just have found something better. Okay. Hi.
So we've had a substitution.
Okay, you're switched.
Hi. Hello.
And they're right.
Greetings.
I
just wanted to go back to a point you made a bit earlier where you were talking. It might take me a minute to get my question out.
Sure.
I've been thinking about what you're saying rather than my question.
Thank you.
When you said that it's unnatural for us to die, I understand by that you mean that it's unnatural for us, for the ultimate to die, because that is a fact of happening. However, clearly it is natural for myself,
right,
personally, to die. Now, I don't feel personally, although when I get nearer to it, relatively, I might fear death, but I don't fear death now,
mm-hmm.
nor do I think I fear pain or suffering. I'm not experiencing it now. And for me, I find that I do find a great eternal happiness in pretty much every experience that I have. And even when I'm in pain or I'm suffering, I know that it won't last forever. And that for me is something lovely. Because I know that yes, I will one day die, but that's fine, because the components are going to form in my body, will not. And maybe that soul, that consciousness within me again, will not, because it is part of something greater. However, that does not mean for me that I feel necessary. That means that for me, it doesn't feel necessary for me to say, you know, when I say I go to a club, to use your example, and I dance the whole night away, and I might be high and whatever, you know, that's great. And I have a memory of that experience, and I can enjoy it so much and feel uplifted during that time, and then go away, and maybe I'll feel like crap the next day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll think, oh, you know, that was a really, really fun experience,
mm-hmm.
and it was nice. And I know that it doesn't last forever. But in a way, I wouldn't want it. Because it's me being here finite in my human capacity. That's the way I want to be, because I am that.
Okay.
Regardless of the fact that there is this underlying truth, which I do believe in. But
okay.
I don't know if my happiness is any less, if it's impossible for me to find happiness in that way of living, rather than in them turning to a life of renouncement.
Okay. Let's look at some of those points one by one. You're not fearful of death, you're not fearful of pain. And that's fine. I didn't come to, you know, to strike fear of pain and death in you all. That's not the point. But it's unwelcome. that much is there. You know, if I advertise that we're, you know, come here and we're going to put you through some real pain, I wouldn't be seeing you. It's unwelcome, and it's inevitable. You know, so it's an unhappy sort of an affair that I don't really want pain, and I'm stuck with it. Death, okay, I'm not afraid of it, but if it comes knocking on the door, I'd rather not answer. Okay, so these are unwelcome visitors that we can't really turn away. That's my point, not that you have to have fear of it. Now, your next point seems to be that, and there's a sort of a curious, paradox there, that you get eternal pleasure by sequentially enjoying temporary things. Something like that. That the sequential enjoyment of temporary things equals permanent pleasure.
Not quite, but accepting the paradox, accepting that this is only temporary, and
right.
Tomorrow I might suffer.
Right.
But then
kind of live for the moment or seize the day and get what you can out of it now. Yeah, you can take that approach, but if there's something higher while you're busy seizing the temporary thing, you're losing the better thing. They say that there's a, now let's see, I've forgotten the Sanskrit, but it's an interesting set of turned phrases. The person who gives up the eternal for the temporary loses both. He loses the eternal because he gave it up, and he loses the temporary because it's temporary. And the person who gives up the temporary for the eternal doesn't lose anything. Because the temporary, what he gave up, he was going to lose anyway, and the eternal is permanent.
If it does exist.
If it does exist.